This week, the FBI has been illegally tracing your phone calls for years. R-rated films in Australia now treated the same as porn. Italian government now must approve all videos before you upload them to the internet. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 12 for Thursday, January 21st. 2010.
This is about not having a public debate, not about secrecy. This is about marginalizing consumers and marginalizing the public. It's not really about secrecy. That is really untrue. It's really a very cynical effort to only empower some people to have a real role in these debates. You got the 96 agreement without secrecy. WIPO is completely transparent. The TRIPS Council puts its minutes on the internet. All these other IPR negotiations, this was created outside, and they're trying to create a new institution. There's a paper, one of the secret papers is to create a new institution for ACTA. That thing should be debated. These are really big issues of public policy.
Well, for more on this latest initiative, I'm joined by Andrew Robinson, head of the Pirate Party in the UK. Hello, Mr. Robinson. Thank you for joining us here on RT. I'd like to begin by asking you, what effect will this bill have on the development of the internet in the UK?
This is going to have a terrible impact on the internet in Britain. We're already dropping behind the rest of the world in terms of broadband speeds that you can get here. And because the cost of this bill is going to be so massive, estimated at around £500 million for the implementation, that's going to have to be charged to general users of the internet by broadband companies. So the cost of getting the internet in Britain is going to go right up, which is obviously going to deter quite a lot of people from having the internet. So we're going to be more of a third world country in internet terms than we are already.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control points. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien. Welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And the two intro clips that I had off the top of the show was the ACTA that was... ACTA was debated during this video. It's an hour and a half of video that you can find on boingboing.net. You can find that link in the Pirate Party forums. That was sent in by Crunch. A good listen there. And also the second one was Andrew Robinson, the head of the Pirate Party UK, being interviewed on Russia Today about the digital web bill going in the UK. And that was from a link I found on the Pirate Party UK site. And also I want to thank Epics for the great new logo for Pirate Party Radio, which you can see on the website, piratepartyradio.com. It's the broadcast tower, and with the Pirate Party logo flag in a circle at the top. And you can download it in vector format on the website, so you can make up your own backgrounds or whatever you want to do with it. So you can make it into whatever you want. And it's, I think it's a perfect symbol for the Pirate Party Radio broadcasting to the world about everything that is going on in the world. And we have some incoming messages. This one is from Crunch. Sorry if it's already been covered. I'm still catching up on Pirate Party Radio. You keep covering this story about the guy who allegedly accidentally downloaded child porn and then deleted it. He was later prosecuted, but it was found on his drive in the free space using tools for disk forensics. There are free tools out there that can cleanly wipe up free space on your disk without touching your actual data. I don't know a specific Windows tool off the top of my head, but I'm sure your listeners do. In Mac OS X, by opening Disk Utility, selecting a particular disk, and going to the Erase tab, you'll find an Erase Free Space button. In Linux, the Secure Delete and BC Wipe tools can do this. As a part of good data hygiene, it's a good idea to wipe out your free space once a month, and even better to do it once a week. It's easy enough to kick it off before you head to bed. Many of us live to explore the internet and the media it can connect us to. All explorers will sometimes find things they wish they hadn't. We shouldn't be forever haunted for this if we exercise the good judgment to discard those pieces of media. So some good words of advice from Crunge, and I know there's some good tools out there for Windows, OS X, and Linux that can really wipe your hard drive clean. Go over it with ones and zeros, random data over and over again, or overwrite it with other data that to kind of cover anything else on your hard drive that you might have accidentally ran into and is cached on your computer. And that's the story he's referring to. Some guy was arrested for things that he ran across on the internet. We all get pop-ups, or, well, if you don't have a pop-up on disabler, you'll run across pop-ups that have some stuff on it that maybe that you don't want on your computer. So it's a good idea to go through your computer once in a while and get rid of all those cached files and images, and keep your computer clean, keep your computer footprint clean. And if you'd like to contact me or ask a question or leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and just fill out the easy feedback form I have on there and click send. Now, in pirate news, privacy news from the U.S. sent in by Ryan Martin. FBI broke law for years in phone record searches, is from the WashingtonPost.com. The FBI illegally collected more than 2,000 U.S. telephone call records between 2002 and 2006 by invoking terrorism emergencies that did not exist, or simply persuading phone companies to provide records, according to internal bureau memos and interviews. FBI officials issued approvals after the fact to justify their actions. Emails obtained by the Washington Post detail how counterterrorism officials inside the FBI headquarters did not follow their own procedures that were put in place to protect civil liberties. The stream of urgent requests for phone records also overwhelmed the FBI Communication Analysis Unit with work that ultimately was not connected to imminent threats. A Justice Department Inspector General's report due out this month is expected to conclude that the FBI frequently violated the law with its emergency requests, bureau officials confirmed. The records seen by the Post do not reveal the identities of the people whose phone call records were gathered, but FBI officials said that they thought that nearly all the requests involved terrorism investigations. FBI General Counsel Valerie Caproni said in an interview Monday that the FBI technically violated the Electronic Communications Privacy Act when agents invoked non-existent emergencies to collect records. "We should have stopped those requests from being made that way," she said. "After the fact approvals were a good-hearted but not well-thought-out solution to put phone carriers at ease," she said. In true emergencies, Caproni said, agents always had the legal right to get phone records, and lawyers have now concluded that there was no need for after-the-fact approval process. What this turned out to be was a self-inflicted wound, she said. Caproni said FBI Director Robert S. Mueller III did not know about the problems until late 2006 or early 2007, after the Inspector General's probe began. Documents show that senior FBI managers up to the assistant director level approved the procedures for emergency requests of phone records, and that headquarters officials often made the requests, which persisted for 2 years after bureau lawyers raised concerns and an FBI official began pressing for changes. "We have to make sure that we're not taking advantage of the system, that we're following the letter of the law without jeopardizing national security," FBI lawyer Patrice K. wrote in one of the series of early 2005 emails asking superiors to address the problem. The FBI acknowledged in 2007 that one that one unit in the agency had improperly gathered some phone records, and a Justice Department audit at the time cited 22 inappropriate requests to phone companies for searches and hundreds of questionable requests. By the latest revision, revelations show that the improper requests were much more numerous under the procedures approved by the top level of the FBI. So, big problem going on, unapproved requests asking the phone companies. The phone companies are complying because it's the FBI asking. They're not going to be able to question that the FBI is doing legal or non-legal searches. It's the FBI. They should be able to be trusted. So these are coming to light. Well, they've been coming to light for a long time now, but they're finally being thoroughly investigated. And we're going to be finding out more details as things go on about how these were obtained, how the FBI managed to convince these phone companies to hand over records that they did not go through the proper approval procedures. So if the government can't be trusted, who else can we trust with our data? We can't trust the phone companies anymore with our data because they'll hand it over to the government, which, in my opinion, is not an unreasonable thing. If the government comes up to you and asks for information, you should reasonably assume that they've gone through the proper procedures. But in this case, everything should be documented by the phone companies that these requests were made. But the problem there is sometimes they're not even allowed to talk about these requests because it's under the guise of national security. And this is the cloak that they're hiding behind to get these requests pushed through so quickly and secretly. So thankfully, these are coming to light. We can find out about them. Some more privacy news from the U.S. Network flaw causes scary web error. And this is sent in by Malcav from Breitbart.com. A Georgia mother and her two daughters logged onto Facebook from mobile phones last weekend and wound up in a startling place. Strangers' accounts with full access to troves of private information. The glitch, the result of a routing problem at the family's wireless carrier, AT&T, revealed a little-known security flaw with far-reaching implications for everyone on the internet, not just Facebook users. In each case, the internet lost track of who was who. Well, they say the internet. Putting the woman into the wrong accounts. It doesn't appear the users could have done anything to stop it. The problem adds a dimension to the researchers' warnings that there are many ways online information, from mundane data to dark secrets, can go awry. Several security experts said that they had not heard of a case like this, in which the wrong person was shown a web page whose username and password had been entered by someone else. It's not clear whether such episodes are rare or simply not reported, but experts said such flaws could occur on email services, for instance, that something similar could happen on a PC, not just a phone. The fact that it did happen is proof that it could potentially happen again with something a lot more important than Facebook, said Nathan Hamiel, founder of the Hexagon Security Group, a research organization. Candace Sawyer, 26, said she immediately suspected something was wrong when she tried to visit her Facebook page Saturday morning. After typing Facebook.com into her Nokia smartphone, she was taken into the site without being asked for a username and password. She was in an account that didn't look like hers. She had fewer friend requests than she remembered, and then she found a picture of the page's owner. "He's white, I'm not," she said with a laugh. Sawyer logged off, then asked her sister, Marie, 31, her partner in a dessert catering company, and her mother, Fran, 57, to see whether they had the same problem on their phones. Marie landed inside another woman's page. Fran's phone, which had never been used to access Facebook before, took her inside yet another stranger's page, one belonging to a young woman from Indiana. They sent an email to one of their own accounts to prove it. They were dumbfounded. "I thought it was the phone. Maybe this phone is just weird and it does magical, horrible things and I have to get rid of it," said Candace Sawyer. The women who live together in East Point, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, had recently upgraded to the same model of phone and all use the same carrier, AT&T. Sawyer contacted the Associated Press after reporting the problem to Facebook and AT&T. The problem wasn't in the phones. It was a flaw in the infrastructure connecting the phones to the internet. That illuminates a grave problem. Generally, websites and computers are compromised from within. A hacker can get a web page or computers to run programming code that they shouldn't. But in this case, it was a security gap between the phone and the website that exposed strangers' Facebook pages to Sawyer's. Misconfigured equipment, poorly written network software, or other technical errors could have caused AT&T to fumble the information flowing from Sawyer's phones to Facebook and back. Fortunately, Hamill said, the vulnerability would have limited use to a hacker interested in pulling off widespread mayhem because the hole would let him access only one account at a time. To do more damage, the criminal would have to pull off unlikely feat of gaining full control of the piece of equipment that routes internet traffic to individual users. AT&T spokesman Michael Coe said its wireless customers have landed in the wrong Facebook pages in a limited number of instances and that a network problem behind those episodes is being fixed. The Sawyer's experience a different glitch. Coe said an investigation points to a misdirected cookie. A cookie is a file some websites place on computers to store identifying information, including the username that a Facebook members would enter to access their pages. Coe said technicians couldn't figure out how the cookie had routed to the wrong place, leading into the wrong Facebook account, etc., etc., etc. So they're surfing on their phone, and they end up on somebody else's Facebook page. Now, you could say, don't enter in things into Facebook that you wouldn't want the public to know. Well, even so, you can get all this information about their friends, their family, their schools that they attended, security-type information that could be used on bank sites. So if you can find out what kind of schools they went to, their dog's name, things like that, their mother's name, you can find links on their webpage that is not normally open to the public, you could possibly compromise bank account information. So it doesn't really matter that you could only access one page associated with each phone that you have. Maybe you can kind of reset the phone and it would give you another cookie that would direct you to a different person's Facebook account. This is a huge hole in security. So what's the solution here? Maybe not use Facebook at all. Things like this are going to happen, so you've got to be prepared that if this thing is things are not secured and encrypted on your own accounts that you only have the encryption core for, you can't trust other companies with your sensitive data. That's what it really boils down to. You can't expect them to take care of your security. You have to take care of your own security with security that you've analyzed and know to be trusted. Now, there's more and more of these screw-ups happening with companies, and it's pointing people more and more to alternate solutions. Hopefully, that they're waking up, that they can't trust companies with their data. You've got to trust only yourself with your own data. And copyright news from the UK. Everything you need to refute a file-sharing legal threat. This is from sent in by Paul. This is from torrentfreak.com. I may have gone over this earlier, but this is very important in the upcoming slew of peer-to-peer and copyright infringement things that are going on in the world, especially with ACTA being prepared to be unleashed onto the world with copyright reforms in every country that's part of this, many dozens of countries. So listen to this. A new wave of cash demands connected with allegations of illicit file sharing are being received this week. In response, consumer group Being Threatened has produced the most informative handbook ever created, empowering those wrongfully accused to refute the claims against them and hold on to their hard-earned cash. Back in November 2009, our exclusive report forecast that thousands of UK internet users would soon be receiving cash demands in connection with allegations of illicit file sharing after lawyers ACS Law were granted more court orders to obtain their identities. James Bench from Being Threatened, a consumer group dedicated to helping those wrongfully accused by this law firm and their partners, such as Germany-based DigiProtect, told Torrent Freak that people are starting to receive them this week. A small number have arrived to date, fittingly by the cheapest and most unreliable regular posted method available in the UK, second class. So far, the unreliability of the evidence appears not to be addressed. Bench explains, 100% of the victims contacting being threatened as a result of the new batch states that they did not commit or authorize any copyright infringement of the work they're being accused of sharing. Indeed, the unreliability of the evidence presented as part of these threatening letters has been raised yet again, by this time by the lords involved in the digital economy bill debate. Following on from his earlier criticisms on Monday, Lord Lucas noted that the firm making these accusations are not nice people to fall foul of. They are not nice to deal with, and later adding, the methods that they use to extract money are not nice. Lord Lucas went on to explain that ACS Law had been kind enough to write him in person, but went on to criticize the evidence their allegations are based on, noting that the evidence is provided by foreign companies that do not disclose the methodology used to obtain it. Lord Lucas observed, it may have well been attained by against data protection rules. That is certainly the conclusion that the Swiss and French authorities seem to have reached. Describing the allegations as totally impenetrable, Lord Lucas said upon receiving these letters telling account holders that they have to pay money. People have no way of disproving that what they're accused of. I think that most of their income comes from people who just pay, he said. I'm not aware that there have been many court cases at the end because of this element of bluff. To be more precise, ACS Law has never taken anyone to court on file-sharing allegations, even though they threaten to. Of course, the bluffing strategy can work both two ways. Those who refuse to pay, admit nothing, and stand their ground against any wrongful allegations can also find out that they come on top. So how does a complete novice in legal matters stand up to these threats and summon the courage to do so in the face of these totally impenetrable allegations? Simple. All they have to do is grab a copy of the Speculative Invoicing Handbook, just released by Being Threatened under a Creative Commons license. If you have been sent a letter demanding cash for an alleged copyright infringement, do nothing until you've read this handbook cover to cover. It is 100% free, absolutely comprehensive, and could save you hundreds of pounds. And it can be downloaded from the Being Threatened website. So go surf over to the Being Threatened website and take a look, because you could be targeted next. You don't know what is coming in the mail from some random company on the internet accusing you of wrongdoing. And this, if you've done nothing wrong, and maybe they've got the IP address wrong, they've got their wires crossed, you have a compromised computer, you have a compromised Wi-Fi access point, maybe you're a pub owner and that you have Wi-Fi available for your users, and one of these users does something that now you're accused of, or you know, somebody comes over to your house and uses your computer to do something, it's on your shoulders. That's the name that they have, that's the address that they have, and they're sending these bills to you. And it really reminds me of these scams that are pulled off where some no-name company sends an invoice to a larger company for a bill for $50, $100, $200. And it looks legitimate. It's for, you know, paper or fax repair service. And, you know, these bigger companies don't even look into it. They just go, okay, pay the bill. I don't know if we deal with this company. And it's a scam. Just like this is a scam. They have no hard proof that they're not even revealing how they do this to the person that they're sending it to. All they're doing is sending a bill to you, threatening you to take you to court when they don't, and making you pay money. So don't be intimidated. Go to Being Threatened and check it out. Free speech news from Italy. Scary stuff. This is sent in by Epics. Proposed web video restrictions cause outrage in Italy. This is from thestandard.com. New rules to be introduced by government decree will require people who upload videos onto the internet to obtain authorization from the communications ministry, similar to that required by television broadcasters, drastically reducing freedom to communicate over the web. Opposition lawmakers lawmakers have been warned. The decree is ostensibly an enactment of the European Union Directive on Product Placement and is due to go into effect at the end of January after being subjected to a non-binding appraisal by Parliament. On Thursday, opposition lawmakers held a press conference in Parliament to denounce the new rules, which require government authorization for uploading of videos, give individuals who claim to have been who defamed a right to reply and prevent the replay of copyrighted material as a threat to freedom of expression. The decree subjects the transmission of images on the web to rules of typical of television and requires prior ministerial authorization with an incredible limitation on the way the internet currently functions. Opposition Democratic Party lawmaker Paolo Gentiloni told the press conference. Article 4 of the decree specifies that the dissemination over the internet of moving pictures, whether or not accompanied by sound, requires ministerial authorization. Critics say it will therefore apply to the websites of newspapers, to IPTV, and to mobile television, obligating them to take on the same status as television broadcasters. Italy joins the club of censors, together with China, Iran, North Korea, said Gentiloni's party colleague Vincenzo Vita. The decree was also condemned by Articolo 21, an organization dedicated to the defense of freedom of speech as enshrined on Article 21 of the Italian Constitution. The group said that measures resembled an earlier government attempt to crack down on bloggers by imposing on them the same obligations and responsibilities as newspapers. The group launched an appeal Friday entitled Hands Off the Net, saying the restrictive measures would mark the end of freedom of expression on the web. The restrictions would prevent the recounting of the life of Italians in moving pictures on the internet, it said. The decree was also criticized by Nicola D'Angelo, a commissioner in the Communications Authority, which would be likely to play a role in policing copyright violations under the new rules. The decree ran contrary to the spirit of the EU directive by extending the rules of television to online video material, D'Angelo said in a radio interview. So this is very interesting. First of all, I didn't know that it had to go through the government in Italy to broadcast things on television. You have to get everything approved first before you show it to the public. A little bit restrictive and a little bit backwards. So now they're extending this already kind of restrictive law onto the internet, so you can't upload a video of your child's birthday to the internet to show your relatives. It is outlawed without the government seal of approval in Italy. Now, this is extremely restrictive, and like they said in the article, this is going to pretty much stop the material from everyday citizen of Italy and stop the viewing of society of Italy on the internet. Nothing will come out of Italy in video form, because I'm sure if you've gone to YouTube, you see millions and millions of videos going through YouTube all the time. Now, is the government going to set up a huge network of people going through videos and approving them hundreds, thousands a day? No, it's going to slow down to a crawl. It's not going to happen. So this is a huge blow to free speech in Italy. And like it said in the article, they already tried to apply this to bloggers. So they're restricting freedom of speech in words and video. And I'm not surprised if they extend this to audio as well, so they can monitor the copyright infringements that may take place. And I think earlier in the article, they hinted to any commercialization of commercial products, and that's what they're going under the guise of the restrictions, so you don't misuse commercial products in your video. Say, perchance, that there's some sort of billboard in behind. And you see this more and more in movies and television, especially in reality television, where everything's blurred out. All you see is the person's face, and the whole background is blurred because everything is subject to copyright. It's a blurry television show. And movies, you come to expect now that any product in a movie is not there by chance. It's a product placement. And if it's not a product placement, it says COLA on it and nothing specific. Next, copyright news from the UK. UK independent editor claims it may steal any image posted on Flickr. And this was sent in by Bethany Jolly, the record keeper of the US Pirate Party, from boingboing.net. This comes from. The independent used a photograph by Peter Zaboulis without asking his permission. The photo question is marked all rights reserved, meaning that the photographer didn't offer any license to use it. A wee fact that the indie missed. Normally, when this sort of thing happens, emails are sent, accommodations are made, and the situation is resolved. In this case, the teaching moment is that when Flickr API feeds you the content, but not a license to use it. But when Zaboulis contacted the Indy, a major newspaper in the UK, the respondent instead claimed that by posting the picture to Flickr, he had abandoned his rights, even if Flickr's terms of service, not to mention the law, says otherwise. We took a stream from Flickr, which is, as you know, a photo-sharing website. This is what they're saying. The legal assumption, therefore, is that you were not asserting your copyright in that arena. We did not take the photo from Flickr, nor present it in anything other than it is shown here. I do not consider, therefore, that any copyright has been breached or any payment due. Freely sharing one's work is a popular choice, but it's not the choice that Zaboulis made here. Moreover, the independent didn't attribute the work, responding disrespectfully to his inquiry, and offers no fair use defense or even a transgressive rationale for what it did. Just tough shit, old boy. Safe in the knowledge that the legal recourse is an option to only those who can afford it. Now, they continued to go back and forth after this article was published, and updated today, I think, didn't put a date, either today or yesterday, and on Peter's Flickr page, it says, this issue has now been resolved, payment has been agreed, and apology has been received. So they finally did apologize for the back and forth that they went with the independent, because they didn't expect this guy was a very popular photographer, and he posted all of his back and forth on his Flickr site, and a lot of people got wind of it because he takes amazing photos. If you want to go over there and take a look at his photos, they're absolutely mind-blowing. And this was a photo of the winter, a winter scene with tire tracks on a hill, I believe, with some trees in the background. It was amazing, amazing shot. And the independent just put this picture on their page without saying it was from Peter. And so it's a large corporation kind of speaking out both sides of their mouth. The corporations, they say that you can't take their stuff and use it the way you want for doing remixes or taking samples or anything like that, but they can freely take public stuff, you know, people invented by stuff that was made by the public. So therefore it's public. No, it's not public. People have the same rights and freedoms as the corporations. They can't have it both ways. They're not a special entity in the sky that dictates what the common person does. It can't go both ways. Either there's copyright for everyone or there's copyright for no one. Granted, the copyright's a little long right now, but they still have to respect that everything is copyrighted and to ask for permission and to do things in the right way. Now, he didn't want this picture used in the way that they're using it. He didn't want it for commercial purposes, and they didn't read the agreement. They just went, took the picture. Oh, that's a nice picture. I'll put it on our website. Now, if it went the other way around, and somebody took a picture off of the independent, some picture that they paid a photographer to take, now they wouldn't be so accommodating using the same exact argument. Let's see. Because it was a photo-sharing website. Say they had a photo-sharing section on their website, on the independent. Would they be so kind as to give these pictures away for free? Probably not. They would send out threatening letters. I'm just guessing here. And the next one, in free culture news from Australia, sent in by Ryan Martin. All R-rated films to be treated like porn in South Australia. It's from gizmodo.com.au. Maybe all lazy parents should move to South Australia, because everyone's favorite state government seems to be doing all your parenting for you. The South Australian government is now enforcing a law that requires all R-rated films for sale or hire to be segregated from all other movies of a lower rating. Not only that, but advertising R-rated films will also be illegal. Essentially, this law is going to affect two types of businesses: places that sell or hire DVDs and Blu-ray films, everywhere from Target to Blockbuster, and cinemas. The first change in the law, which says you can't display R-rated movies alongside movies of other ratings, requires a dedicated area for all R-rated content, which needs to be clearly marked with this statement, in font at least 15 millimeters high. R, 18 plus films area. The public are warned that material displayed in this area may cause offense. In addition to that, the item's surface area, such as a DVD cover, may not be more than 300 square centimeters, which is bigger than a DVD cover. The other alternative is to remove any covers or displays other than the name of the movie in a font no larger than 1 centimeter high and the rating. No description, no funny quotes from Margaret Pomeranz, nothing. I'm guessing she's an Australian movie reviewer. So now, if you want to visit your local video store in South Australia to hire a copy of, let's say, Bruno or The Hangover, the only way you'll be able to find it is by trudging through the releases like Fuck Me in the Ass and Say That You Love Me or Real Babes, Real Breasts. Either that, or you have no idea about the content of the film other than the film's name and its rating. The second part of the new law restricts the ability to advertise R 18 plus rated films. Businesses, including cinemas, can no longer show trailers for R rated films or display promotional material such as posters, pamphlets, or other printed material. Although this probably won't be too big a problem, very few theatrical releases have been classified R18 plus in recent years. Most make it as an MA15 for most businesses. Still though, it's enough to guarantee that I'll never move to that South Australia. So this is particularly worrying for people who live in Australia. See, either they're not going to get the same movies as the rest of the world, or because the movie chain just won't carry them anymore because they can't even advertise them or sell them properly, or they're going to get watered down, censored versions, the Australian version of the movie, which is not a great alternative. So be warned, people in Australia, your movies are going to be starting to be watered down, bleeped out, sections cut out of them. You're not going to get the same movie as the directors intended. So keep your eyes open and maybe look for imports. Or unless they restrict those too. Maybe you can't even import R-rated movies into Australia. Sad, sad stuff. Open government news from the UK. Britain frees its data. This is from telegraph.co.uk. This is a bit of good news, finally. Government data is to be made public to software developers for the first time. The data.gov.uk website will be launched by Sir Tim Berners-Lee tomorrow, Friday, 21st of January, and we'll see Britain following in the footsteps of America's data.gov website. Information on topics ranging from house prices to air quality will be among the data that will be released, and the hope is that software developers will build computer programs that will make government information more widely available to the general public. This would emulate President Obama's acclaimed Apps for Democracy project. The government has previously sponsored a £20,000 prize to encourage people to use public sector information. The A Better Way project fostered applications detailing school catchment areas, cycle paths, and postbox locations. London has recently also launched a data store at london.data.gov.uk. As the scheme continues, the aim is for more government information to be made public automatically, and for different departments to link their data together so its implications are more immediately apparent. Sir Tim, the computer scientist often credited for inventing the World Wide Web, has previously said that even in his original plans for the web, he saw data as a crucial to its success if it was to change the relationship between individual citizens and large companies and government. So it's a bit of good news there in open government. So we'll be able to analyze, or the people in the UK will be able to analyze the data that its government gets, the data that the citizens pay for. So they'll be able to analyze it and sift through it, and there'll be some nice websites out there that'll present it in nice format so you can analyze it yourself. In privacy news from the US, does the Fourth Amendment cover the cloud? Sent in by Ryan Martin. This is from CNET.com. One of the biggest issues facing individuals and corporations choosing to adopt public cloud computing, or any internet service for that matter, is a relative lack of clarity with respect to legal rights over data stored online. I've reported on this early legal landscape a couple of times, looking at decisions to relax expectations for privacy for email stored online and the decisions to allow the FBI to confiscate servers belonging to dozens of companies from a co-location facility whose owners were suspected of fraud. However, while I've argued before that the government has yet to apply the right metaphor to the modern world of networked applications and data, there has been little literature that has actually dissected the problem in detail. Even worse, I've seen almost no analysis of how the United States Constitution's Fourth Amendment, which guards against unreasonable search and seizures, applies to internet-housed data. However, I just had the pleasure of reading an extremely well-written note in the June 2009 edition of the Minnesota Law Review titled Defogging the Cloud, Applying Fourth Amendment Principles to Evolving Privacy Expectations in Cloud Computing, written by David A. Couillard, a student at the University of Minnesota Law School, expecting to graduate this year. The paper is concise but a thorough outline of where we stand with respect to the application of Fourth Amendment law to internet computing. It finishes by introducing a highly logical framework for evaluating the application of the Fourth Amendment to cases involving cloud-based data. According to Couillard, we aren't very far along at all today. Under a rubric of reasonable expectations of privacy, the court has since defined the contours of the Fourth Amendment's application in varying circumstances. But technology and society's expectations are evolving faster than the law. Although statutory schemes exist, some argue that these laws are outdated. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has not even addressed the Fourth Amendment's application to email, let alone the expanding uses of cloud computing platforms. Thus, Fourth Amendment law needs a framework that will adapt more quickly in order to keep pace with evolving technology. I stated essentially the same thing my cloud computing Bill of Rights back in 2008. In order for enough trust to be built into the online cloud economy, however, governments should endeavor to build a legal framework that respects corporate and individual privacy and overall data security. While national security is important, government must be careful not to create an atmosphere in which customers and vendors of the cloud distrust their ability to securely conduct business within the jurisdiction, either directly or indirectly. So it goes on, a very interesting application of the law in the U.S. in respect to privacy. Now, I've stated earlier in this show and before that you can't expect privacy in cloud computing, like storing your email with a provider or Facebook or any of these kind of social applications that are online. You're giving information to them that you're expecting some sort of level of privacy, but it's been shown again and again that there is no level of privacy. There's leaks, there's data being left lying around all the time. The government going in and getting information that they're not even supposed to get without through the proper channels. There is no expectation of privacy. People have lost a lot of confidence in these online computing applications. So it's very interesting to see that people are actually starting to analyze these things. And so there is no expectation of privacy, as they're stating. The next story, copyright news from Canada. The EU pressures Canada to ignore Canadians on copyrights. This is from michaelgeist.ca web blog, and it was sent in by DC. Canada and the European Union resume negotiations on a Canada-EU trade agreement this week. The second round of talks comes as the EU proposed chapter for the intellectual property provisions leaked last month, revealing demands for dramatic changes to Canadian intellectual property law. This would include copyright term extension to life of the author plus 70 years, anti-circumvention rules, resale rights, and ISP liability provisions. Now that a second document is leaked, though it is not currently available online, the Wire Report reports that an EU document dated November 16, 2009 features candid comments about Canada and the EU strategy. The document, called a barrier hymn sheet, leaves little doubt about the EU's objective. put pressure on Canada so that they take IPR issues seriously and remedy many of the shortcomings that their IPR protection and enforcement regime. Having viewed the document, I can report that it goes downhill from there, promoting the key message that Canadian laws are inadequate, while liberally quoting a report from the Canadian IP Council and discrediting counterfeiting data. The document states that the trade negotiations are a unique opportunity for Canada to upgrade its IPR regime despite anti-IPR lobbying. It includes an assessment of recent copyright reform efforts, noting that two bills have died due to political instability. The document adds that copyright reform process was revived in 2009 with the National Copyright Consultation, but notes dismissively that it has been a tactic to confuse. It ultimately concludes, "Our objective is to convince Canada to eliminate or reduce these shortcomings by conducting the necessary legislatives and other changes. However, optimism should be tempered since despite pressures from the USA, high-level commitments from Canada, and our commissioner's letter of April 2009, little concrete moves have been observed in recent years. We hope the negotiations of the bilateral CETA will provide a good opportunity to extend pressure on Canada regarding the upgrade of its IPR regime. This document, combined with the leaked draft, provides ample evidence of the intent of the EU to use CETA to pressure Canada to fundamentally reshape our copyright and IP laws. Although the document discloses that IP was not discussed at the first round of negotiations in Ottawa last October, it is clear that the high-priority future agenda item. Indeed, the Wire report reports that IP is on the agenda for this week's negotiations, although the Wire report quotes a government official as saying the CETA will not override the copyright consultations when combined with the ACTA talks that resume next week. The proposed of a made-in-Canada approach may be quickly slipping away. So there's a lot of down pressure on Canada from places like the U.S. with very draconian copyright laws of the life plus 70, life of the author plus 70, which is completely outrageous. The authors died. The stuff that you've seen in your lifetime, you'll never ever be able to use in a public domain setting. You'll never be able to do remixes. You'll never be able to use these things in a report for fear of the copyright cops coming down upon you for misuse of copyright. The great grandchildren are still reaping the benefits of something that they didn't even meet the person that they are related to who made up these things. So it's pushing Canada into a realm where it doesn't need to go. The copyright laws are already way too restrictive as it is already in Canada, and even worse in the US and other places around the world. And it's these large corporations that are putting the pressure on Canada so that they can extend their copyrights and continue the money mill. Rather than inventing new things, they can just keep reaping the rewards of things that were invented 70 plus years ago. Way too long. Privacy news from Sweden. Pirate Bay's iPredator VPN opens to the public. It's from torrentfreak.com. After months of waiting, the iPredator anonymity search service from the founders of the Pirate Bay has finally opened its doors to the public. For €5 a month, users can now hide all their internet traffic, including torrent downloads from third-party outfits who might want to spy on their downloading habits. In the last year, pressure from the entertainment industries and the ISPs and governments to crack down on copyright infringements has steadily increased, resulting in ISPs sending out mass copyright warnings. This, of course, is coupled with the looming specter of the three strikes legislation aimed at disconnecting copyright infringers. File sharers, on the other hand, haven't been sitting still either, as many have chosen to negate these initiatives by going anonymous. Users of BitTorrent and other file sharing networks have increasingly turned to solutions that hide their identities from the outside world, rendering these new anti-piracy initiatives useless. The iPredator service from the founders of the Pirate Bay opened up to the public this week and is undoubtedly the most talked about newcomer in the business, with the beta launching coinciding with the introduction of the controversial iPred law in Sweden, the service promises to offer users an anonymous connection to the internet. iPred gave the copyright holders increased power to track down pirates. With the launch of iPredator, the creators neutralized this new threat. Much like other comparable VPN services, iPredator allow users to connect to the internet while hiding their own IP address. The interest in services like this is booming. In Sweden alone, an estimated 500,000 internet subscribers are already hiding their identities online, and that number is expected to rapidly grow in the new year. iPredator is currently using the same platform as several other VPN franchises, including Relax, which means it's not really anything we've seen before. The services are maintained and provided by the Pirate Bay affiliates, though, which may be more trustworthy to the average BitTorrent user than a random VPN provider. That aside, we were told by the former Pirate Bay spokesman Peter Sunday that the contrary to what the legal page states, no logs of any kind are kept by iPredator. The text is in there is left over from a standard template they got from the provider of a VPN platform. And according to Sunday, there will soon be even more advantages added security to iPredator. So there's something to look at for people who are afraid of the three strikes law unfairly targeting them for things that they didn't do. People don't want to be disconnected from the internet for being accused of things that they're not taken to court for, things that they're only given a piece of paper, three pieces of paper, and you're off the internet. So these are more and more appealing to people that want their security and want their privacy for what they're doing on the internet. So this anonymizes your dealings on the internet by going through a proxy, a VPN, not even a proxy, a VPN, to a Pirate Bay offering service. So this is very interesting. And as more of these stories coming up about copyright infringement and people being threatened and people being threatened to taken to court, more and more people will go anonymous and they'll be driving it underground and making it harder for them to see what the average person is doing. And I think that is wonderful. People, you should be able to keep track of your own bits, and your own bits are your own business. It's nobody else's business but you, what you're doing on the internet. Corporations should not be able to spy on what you're doing on the internet. It's your data. Keep it to yourself and keep it encrypted. Keep it private. Copyright news from the UK. Music file sharer Oink cleared of fraud. A man who ran a music sharing website with almost 200,000 members has been found not guilty of a conspiracy to defraud the Tessie Crown Court. Alan Ellis, 26, was the first person in the UK to be prosecuted for illegal file sharing. He operated the site called Oink from his flat in Middlesbrough from 2004 until it was closed down in a police raid in October 2007. In that time, Oink facilitated the download of 21 million music files. The site allowed active members to find other people on the web who were prepared to share files, enabled users to get a hold of free music. Users were asked to make a donation, although it was not necessary for them to do so, to invite friends to join the site. The jury was told that police found almost $300,000 US in Mr. Ellis's PayPal account and that he receives $18,000 a month in donations from people using his website. Mr. Ellis told the court there was no intention to defraud copyright holders. He said the donations were to pay for the server's rental and any surplus that would eventually be used to buy a server. He agreed that he had about 10 bank accounts with some £20,000 in savings when police raided the house he shared. Giving evidence, Mr. Ellis explained why he set up the website. It was to further my skills, to better my skills for employability. Mr. Ellis said the website was developed from a free template, which had a torrent file sharing facility included in it. Oink did not host any of the music itself. It indexed the files users had available on their computers for others to download. Originally, the site was hosted on his home computer, but by 2007, it had moved to a commercial server in Amsterdam because of the amount of internet traffic it was attracting. Mr. Ellis, who had a full-time job as a software engineer, was born in Leeds and grew up in South Manchester, studying A-levels in Cheadle. He declined to speak as he left the court. And there's a follow-up to this, and this was posted on the Pirate Party UK Twitter feed today. Big Music versus Oink, round two. And it's from P2Pnet.net. Vivendi, Universal, EMI, Warner Music, and Sony Music failed to nail Oink Op Davis under criminal charges. So they're thinking about going after him again, this time in civil courts. The fight isn't over, and Vivendi, Universal, blah, 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 will find other ways, The Telegraph has IFPI boss John Kennedy stating. The big four enforcement outfit is seriously considering launching civil proceedings, said the story. Last week, Ellis, 26, had around $300,000 in his PayPal account when UK police staged a dramatic raid on his house in 2007, P2Pnet said, adding, he was running a music site with some 200,000 site members, so the money must have belonged to the labels, right? Goes without saying. It was invite only, with users having to pay a donation in order to be able to ask their friends to join. This was a hugely disappointing verdict. It has Jeff Taylor, mouthperson for the Vivendi, Universal, EMI, Warner Music, and Sony Music's BPI, saying. So they're taking him to a court again after he's been found not guilty. Oink was an amazing website. It was way better than any other website still out there today. Even the four pay websites where you can buy legitimate music. It had amazing organization. It had amazing levels of downloads from a perfect FLAC rip to lower level MP3 rips of the music. It had associated acts. So you can say, if you like this artist, you could go see this other artist, you might like them as well. It was extremely well organized, and it's the best website I've seen so far for listening to music. And of course, the big companies didn't embrace it. They didn't go with the same model. They just went after him to shut it down. It was too good. They couldn't compete with it. But it was not, you don't have to pay to join. It was free to join. So they've got a little bit mixed up, and that's why they lost the court case in the first one. They said it was releasing music before it came out. That's what it was focused on. It was not. You had to pay to join. You didn't have to pay to join. A lot of other things that they were very misguided about. Very inflammatory stuff, and that's why he was let off. So we'll continue to watch this court case as they're taking him to civil court. So hopefully he will get off on that as well, because he didn't store any of the music. You didn't have to donate to the site, and he didn't store any music. He was a database. That's all. He didn't have any copyrighted works on his servers. There's no infringement going on. Privacy news from the U.S. Microsoft advances search privacy with Bing, sent in by Ryan Martin. This is from MicrosoftOnTheIssues.com. Today, as a part of our ongoing evaluation of Microsoft's internet search privacy practices, we're pleased to announce an important change in our data retention policy. So this is something coming from Microsoft themselves. We will delete the entire internet protocol address associated with search queries after 6 months rather than 18 months. This new and significant step will be incorporated into our existing privacy practices, which already provide strong protection for Bing users. This change is the result of a number of factors, including a continuing evaluation of our business needs, the current competitive landscape, and our ongoing dialogue with privacy advocates, consumer groups, and regulators, including the Article 29 Working Party, the group of 27 European national data protection regulators charged with providing advice to the Europe Commission and other EU institutions on data protection. Under our current policy, as soon as Microsoft receives a Bing search query, we take the steps to de-identify the data by separating it from the account information that could identify the person who performed the search. Then, at 18 months, we take the additional step of deleting the IP address, the de-identified cookie ID, and other cross-session IDs associated with the query. The core components of this policy will not change. Our new policy will change the date at which we delete the IP address associated with the query in 6 months. So, Ryan adds to this, it should be noted that they're talking about the entire IP address being removed. This is far better than what Google does. Google just anonymizes the last byte of the IP address, making your computer one of a pool of 256 computers. So I'm guessing that they're kind of localizing data searches so they can say, well, this came from New York and this came from Los Angeles, and these people in this area like this, or this ISP, this group of people from this ISP likes this. But I find it interesting that it's hailed as good news when we get back our privacy rather than it being loudly decried when it's first taken away. We're like applauding Microsoft for giving back our privacy. Yay, our privacy's back. Thank you so much. It's like thanking somebody when they stop beating you quite so badly. So the story is baffling that it's heralded as awesome news when in fact it's like not awesome news. It's like giving back something that should have been there in the first place. So it's like 6 months. Why do you need my data for 6 months? So these anonymizers are getting more and more appealing all the time, so that these corporations are not stealing your data and retaining it when somebody could go in and take that data and use it for nefarious purposes. Like, would you want all your search queries opened up to the general public associated with your name? Well, that could happen if your data gets out. This person searches for these things, say your medical issues or family problems. Say you're having suicidal thoughts. All of a sudden, you've lost your job for no apparent reason whatsoever because somebody's found out about something. Or your insurance has been canceled if you live in the U.S. Things like that, that kind of important things that can happen if your data privacy is lost. This is very important going into this new era of data retention and collection by large corporations. Be aware of it. That's why this radio show is on. That's why there's pirate parties around. They're out to protect you and your data, which is essentially you. Your data makes up a profile of you. It may be an inaccurate or accurate profile of you, but it's still associated with you, and that's what people see. In international copyright news, IFPI Digital Report 2010, The Sky is Falling Again. This is from Slick.com. We've been reading the IFPI's Digital Music Report since publication began in 2004. Every year it presents a fascinating insight into the complex world of digital music and the marketing struggles that the internet entertainment industry faces. Although the situation appears to be turning around for the music industry between 2006 and 2008, when the RIAA's Mitch Bainwall declared that the P2P piracy had been contained, things only seem to be getting worse, or at least that's what the music industry wants us to believe. The latest digital music report contains plenty of information and stats on digital music sales around the world, but what was particularly striking was the repetitive theme of demanding ISP/legislative involvement to solve the issue digital piracy. In many ways, this is the last stand of the music industry. Almost all other attempts to stop file sharing, such as shutting down Napster, flooding networks with corrupt files, suing customers, educating customers, etc., has failed miserably. All that's left is the ISP. Why the music industry is pushing so hard for ISP legislative intervention? Because its very survival's at stake. If we're to believe the IFPI statistics, fewer and fewer dollars are being spent on investing on new artists. It's no secret that the CD market has all but collapsed thanks to the shift towards digital music. The music industry is under the impression that the only thing driving the file-sharing community is the lure of free music. However, this is hardly the case, as it's an incubator for new technology such as BitTorrent, THT, advanced networking, etc. It's also a place where millions call home, where sophisticated culture has grown since the earliest days of P2P. It's likely that some people simply engage in file sharing just to save a few bucks, but to give a carte blanche declaration that free is the only motivation, especially with mounting evidence that many P2Pers also buy music and drive the industry, is disingenuous. It's not free file sharing that individuals are defending. There's something much more driving than the motivation of the P2P community. The IFPI 2010 Digital Music Report was no doubt one of their most dire written, but they did manage to report some good news. According to the report, in 2009, for the first time ever, more than a quarter of the recorded music industry's global revenues, 27%, came from digital channels, a market worth more than an estimated $4.2 billion in trade value, up 12% on 2008. Additionally, the IFPI found that music sales has risen substantially in Sweden, a success attributed to the recent iPred laws and the court decision against the Pirate Bay. So, they're now applauding digital music sales, where before they were trying to get rid of digital music because they didn't embrace it in time. Now, I'm not so sure that the collapse of the record industry as we know it is all that of a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. The internet has shown us that there's cheaper and more democratic way of distributing music, such as the old site of Oink. Of course, there's lots and lots of websites out there that are similar to Oink, like what.cd, and there's many, many other private sites as well. Even the most unknown musician can now be famous and sell music without the overhead of the music distribution giants of a bygone era. You don't need to go through these giant corporations anymore. You can get your own music out. You can record your own music on your computer and send it to the internet, to YouTube, you playing your own music on a music video. You can send it to all these hundreds of websites through torrents. You don't have to it doesn't have to cost you a dime for distribution. And when people like your music, they can either donate or buy a physical piece of music, or even go to one of these websites where you can pay for the music, like iTunes or some of these other ones where you pay as much as you feel like paying, from like 99 cents to, you know, $10 for the album. And I'll be glad when they're gone, and I won't have to report on the continual whining about how the horse and buggy industry is suffering because of these newfangled cars taking over the internet superhighway. They are a dying breed. The industry is going away, and they're kicking and struggling and trying to convince everyone that the old ways are better than the new ways of distribution. They are not embracing it, and they didn't embrace it quickly enough, and now they're still not embracing it as they once were. They are still kicking and screaming and pointing to the pirate websites going, "You're doing a better job than we are. We can't figure out your model of distribution of music. And we keep putting this DRM on the music and people still keep rejecting it. Why do they hate the restrictions we place on the music?" Well, they're just not offering the freedom and ease of use that the pirate sites are giving you. If you went to a place to download music and it's got DRM on it, and you've downloaded to your computer, and all of a sudden you can't transfer it to your other portable device when you go jogging or you go on the bus to work, then you're going to go, "Why did I even pay for this? What is the point of paying for it when I have to pay for it again or figure out some newfangled way of transporting it to my random device that I bought so I can listen to it on the way to work? Why don't I just head over to the pirate site and download it for free?" Because it not just because it's free, it's because it's easier to use and easier to transfer it from one thing to another. The big industry should stop being so scared of embracing the technology and just go for it and get your music out there. People will pay for convenience. If your music is easily accessible in a nice to easy to use format, people will buy it. People are spending loads of cash at iTunes. Make them spend even more money by making it more accessible. Now, this last story I wasn't going to report on, but I think it's interesting enough to report on, not because of the story, because of the implications. This one's free culture news from the U.S. CBS uncovers rare Jack Benny treasures and puts them back and tosses out the key. And this is from boingboing.net. When Jack Benny fans discovered that CBS vaults contained some 25 original Jack Benny TV show episodes previously thought lost, they rejoiced. They approached the network for release of the public domain footage, even offering to foot the bill for digital transfer and preservation. CBS balked, insisting that the fan club get approval from the Benny estate. No problem, Jack Benny's descendants were only too glad to have his original TV shows rescued from obscurity and given to the world. But CBS balked again, citing unspecified issues, presumably potential copyrights in the score or other materials. Basically, CBS has decided that it would cost too much to pay a lawyer to figure out if they can release the films, or even if they can turn them over to Benny's fans and family for release, and so it has decided to simply abandon them, sealing them back up in the vault forever. This isn't how it's supposed to work. In the Constitution's Progress Clause, Congress is empowered to promote the progress of the arts through copyright. When copyright creates these deadlocks that doom America's artist heritage to history scrap heap, copyright needs to change. Late last week, the International Jack Benny Fan Club got some very bad news. Rather than allow the club, with Benny's family's enthusiastic blessing, to digitally preserve some unreleased public domain Benny show masters that CBS had in its possessions, the network is giving a thumbs down to the idea, thus sealing the show's fate so they'll never be seen again. In effect, it's a bullet through the head of this body of Benny's work. And here's the most frustrating tidbit for comedy fans and those who study comedy. The fan club offered to do the preservation at no cost to CBS. Why does this matter? Benny invented the situation comedy on radio in the 1930s and had perfected timing, assembled a cast of zany characters who poked fun at him, could extend a laugh by the way he slowly panned around the room after a punchline, and influenced comedians such as Kelsey Grammer and Johnny Carson. In his final years, he could literally read a page out of the phone book and get laughs. His final weekly release went off the air in 1964, but he continued to do specials until he died in 1974. Now, I've read through a lot of the pages associated with the story, and both sides are saying the other is lying. They both got alternative agendas. CBS says that they will let companies in and copy for the right price, and the Jack Benny fan club presidents want to copy them and sell them for herself and not release them to the world, but do in effect like copy them and then lock them away themselves and not distribute them for free. And also, CBS doesn't own the rights to the shows anymore because it has gone into public domain, but does own the actual physical media. So really, it is up to them whether or not they want to have somebody copy it or burn it in a big pile out back. So it is CBS's property. They may not own the intellectual property on it or the copyright on it, but they own the tapes that it's on. Nobody can just go in and take the tapes from them and say, I can take these tapes because it's public domain. Just like nobody can walk into your house, take books off your shelf that were written 300 years ago and say, well, I'm taking these books. They're public domain. Well, they are public domain, but they're my books. So there is two sides to this. But the more interesting thing is preserving important media as our culture. Now, what if they did burn these things? What if they got lost? What if there's a fire? What if there's a flood? And all these records that they had that they wouldn't let people copy, or they say they will, but for the right price or the right situation or the right company, because nobody's got it yet and nobody's willing to step up to the plate, maybe it's too expensive. What if they disappear? Now, this has happened before. If people in the UK remember, or even fans of Doctor Who remember, the BBC had loads and loads of old Doctor Who episodes. But what they did is they didn't have enough room for them, so they just deleted them. They got rid of them. They trashed them. They recorded over the tapes. And now they're gone forever. So what if this piece of history, maybe you've heard of Jack Benny, maybe you haven't heard of Jack Benny, but it could apply to anything. And it'd be gone forever. Nobody's will see it ever again. It exists only in memories of people who've already passed away. They're gone because of copyright is so long. It's 70 plus the death of the person. It's such an incredible amount of time that it's not even possible to preserve the media anymore, because the media may have disintegrated by that time, and the copyright holders are not willing to release it because it's either not going to make enough money, or not enough people like it, or there's not enough interest in the companies releasing this. And this is the case here. It's locked away. Nobody can get at it, and maybe it'll disappear. So this is very important issues regarding free culture in our society. It doesn't matter whether it's the works of William Shakespeare or it's Tom Green. It's something that somebody liked at some point, and it's part of our culture, and things are disappearing now because of the overly extended copyright length. It's gone too far for too long, and they keep on pushing it even further to the point where I'm sure they will want copyright to extend to infinity, or at least 150 years. It's already way too long. Anyway, in Pirate Party news, Europe's second pirate MP is still not in office. This is ended by Ryan Martins from TorrentFreak.com. Pirate Party may have won two seats in last June's European Parliament elections, but it's hard to see that in practice. Despite the Lisbon Treaty going into effect over 6 weeks ago, there's still no news when the Pirate Partiet will fill their second seat. Back in June 2009, the Swedish Pirate Party gained an impressive victory over European Parliament elections with 7% of the votes. This got them a seat in the European Parliament, with a possibility for a second if the Lisbon Treaty passed. The treaty was eventually passed in early November and became effective December 1, 2009. While one of the positions created by the treaty, that of the president, was filled immediately and set to work, the same can't be said of the elective representatives in the European Parliament. To date, there's been no information on when the new elective representatives from all around Europe will take office. Pirate Partiet sole MEP Christian Engelstrom is not happy with the way things are being handled. Personally, I find it difficult to understand why they can put the unelected president in office from day one, but don't even have a plan for how to get the elected representatives of the people there, Engstrom told Torrent Freak. When the Pirate Party's representative-in-waiting, 22-year-old Amelia Anders' daughter, and the 17 other new parliament members will be seated is anyone's guess. It is particularly pressing for small parties like Pirate Partiet, though, where the second seat will help increase funding and enable the parties to function better. What effect this snubbing will have in the next round of elections is unclear, but is unlikely to hurt the Pirate Party in countries such as the UK and Sweden during this year's national elections. On the contrary, it may even increase support in protest. Meanwhile, requests for information from the EU on when the MEPs will be seated have so far gone unanswered. And Shea from US Pirate Party adds, it's interesting here that they would indicate that the party would actually benefit from publicity from the disenfranchisement. While it could simply be the weight of the transition, it could also be dragging its heels of the pirate parties in power. It's hard to say from the perspective of the article, but it's fact that this, but the fact that the smaller parties are more affected by the delay than the largest. Ideally, the Pirate Party is less impacted as they are hopefully relying more on the internet than some of their other fellows. Nonetheless, it's good to hear that headway is being made. More news, Pirate Party of Oklahoma seeks official status. This is sent in from Marcus Kessler, and the website is okpirateparty.net. It stands for Oklahoma. Voters in Oklahoma will soon have the potential to exercise democracy in a new and exciting direction. Notice was filed with the Oklahoma State Election Board today that the Pirate Party is coming to the Sooner State. This notice marks the start of a year-long drive to collect thousands of signatures needed to officially register the Pirate Party of Oklahoma, in which what is considered one of the most difficult states for political party recognition. You can get more information from the website, or you can email him directly, info@okpirateparty.net. And there's a Pirate Conference 2010 coming up, and this is from Pirate Party's international website. Dear Pirates, the Pirate Party's International Conference will take place on the 16th through 18th of April 2010 in Brussels. Most of the information below is aimed at Pirate Party leaders, but some is irrelevant to all pirates. So if you're in Brussels or around Brussels, it'd be interesting to know to go there and check out what's going on, because I'm sure all of the important Pirate Party leaders are going to gather there. It says, as it is difficult to get the space to host hundreds of pirates, we have limited financial resources that may have to limit on the number of guest pirates from each party. One of the 2 days will be used for meeting NGOs. The other day will be used for electing the Pirate Party's international board and deciding on formal statutes. We need help to make this possible. We need public speakers for seminars and a call for papers. If you're interested in helping Pirate Party's International set up this conference, please have a look at the post here for more details on what we need. We're also looking for input on some other issues concerning Pirate Party's International. If you have any ideas on how Pirate Party's International should function, please have a look here. And now in a new section, free pirate tools, there's a new one called Google Sharing, and this was sent in by Ryan Martin at googlesharing.net. You can check it out. Google sharing is a special kind of anonymizing proxy service designed for the very specific threat. It ultimately aims to provide a level of anonymity that will prevent Google from tracking your searches, movements, and what websites you visit. Google sharing is not a full proxy service designed to anonymize your traffic, but something designed exclusively for your communication with Google. Our system is totally transparent with no special alternative websites to visit. Your normal workflow should be exactly the same. So go check that out and evaluate it to see if you would trust googlesharing.net rather than you trust Google, because really you still are sending your data through a third-party website to do searches and other things. But check that out, a very interesting stuff. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please go check out your local pirate party to find out more information about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms in your country. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the front page of the website. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.